Imagine you're skating like 20 miles an hour toward a solid fiberglass wall.
Right, just completely flying.
Yeah, and you have this vulcanized rubber disc at your feet that you're trying to control with a, composite stick.
While a 220-pound defenseman is just breathing down your neck.
Exactly. And, deep down, if you bend your head even a fraction of an inch the wrong way right before impact.
You could permanently damage your spine.
Yeah, it's terrifying. But welcome to the daily office of a hockey winger. I mean, to anyone just sitting in the upper bowl with a beer, this game just looks like high-speed, chaotic
Oh,
violence.
for sure, like a demolition derby on ice.
Right. But today, we're taking a deep dive into the source material because we want to dispel that myth. We're going to solve the geometry problem of playing winger. And just to be clear, if you're joining us to get some surface-level overview of where a winger stands during a face-off, you are in the wrong place.
Yeah, we are going way deeper than that.
This is a masterclass. Our mission today is to build a complete, integrated mental model of the winger position. We're pulling from coaching manuals, global rulebook variations, physiological safety data, all of it.
Because surviving as a winger, let alone actually thriving, it requires this really specific, almost neuroplasticity.
Let's unpack that. What do you mean by neuroplasticity in this context?
Well, it's about spatial awareness. It's about, anticipating cascading tactical failures before they even happen. And crucially, it's understanding how these microscopic, nuanced rule differences across different leagues fundamentally dictate your biomechanics.
Like how you are legally allowed to move your body.
Exactly.
So let's start with the physical architecture of the ice itself, because you can run a tactical system if you don't actually understand the physical grid you're operating on.
No, you can't. It's impossible.
Right. And we aren't going to waste time defining basic terms like hash marks or the blue lines. You guys know the rink. But we do need to talk about the concept of the lane.
Yeah, the lane. It's the absolute foundational math of the game.
Because a winger's relationship to their lane seems to dictate the entire flow of the offense, right?
Oh, 100%. If you conceptually divide the ice into three vertical strips running the entire length of the rink, the center operates as the central axis. And the wingers, they act as the outer boundaries.
So your lane is basically the outside third of the ice.
Right. And the reason this matters mechanically is defensive gravity.
Defensive gravity. Okay, break that down for me.
Think about it this way. If you have three forwards pushing up the ice in their three distinct lanes, you are physically stretching the opposing defensive structure across the maximum 85-foot width of the rink.
Like forcing them to spread out.
Exactly. The
Yeah.
defense has to thin themselves out to respect those wide threats.
But the natural instinct, especially for, newer players, is when the puck is loose in the middle of the ice, you want to leave that outside lane and go hunt it.
You see a loose puck, you want to converge on it. It's human nature.
Right. But the moment you do that,
You have completely destroyed your team's mathematical advantage.
just by moving a few feet inside.
Let's trace the cascading effect here. If you, as the right winger, drift out of your lane and collapse into the center lane alongside your centerman to chase a puck, you've just merged two offensive threats into a single physical space.
So the defense doesn't have to work as hard.
Exactly. The opposing defense no longer has to spread out. Two defenders can now easily cover three forwards because the spatial threat is just gone.
Wow. So it is a spacing job long before it ever becomes a scoring job.
I couldn't have said it better.
It actually reminds me of a modern NBA point guard driving to the basket. Like if the shooters on the perimeter suddenly collapse into the paint to help him out.
They just drag all their defenders right in with them.
Right, they clog the lane. The best way to help the puck carrier isn't to get closer to them. It's to stay as far away as possible to keep the passing lanes open.
That is the exact spatial philosophy on the ice. You hold your width to create internal space.
Okay, but holding that width means you are operating right next to the boards,
You are living on the wall.
which demands that we establish some absolute golden rules for physical survival, because the boards are entirely unforgiving.
Yeah, they don't move.
And these safety overrides, they supersede every tactical decision a coach will ever give you, right? Because tactical brilliance doesn't matter much if you're leaving the ice on a stretcher.
Exactly.
Let's talk about the first physiological mandate, taking contact on the wall.
Yeah.
The literature in our source material is aggressively clear on this. You never, under any circumstance, turn your back to the boards to shield the puck.
And there.
But I have to push back here, just logically. In soccer or basketball, putting your body between the defender and the ball is like fundamental protection. Why is it a catastrophic error in hockey?
It comes down to the presence of the boards and the sheer speed of the impact.
Okay.
See, if you're in open ice and you turn your back, a hit will knock you over, sure, but your body can slide, you dissipate the kinetic energy across the ice.
Right, you kind of roll with it.
But when you are 2 feet from the boards stop your momentum instantly. If you turn your back to an incoming checker, your body literally cannot visually brace for the impact.
Because you can't see them coming.
Right. And the medical data from USA Hockey is just, it's terrifyingly specific on this. A hit from behind into the boards does not require high speed to be devastating.
Really? Even a slow hit?
Even a light, seemingly routine check from behind against an unbraced player can inflict severe whiplash, concussion, or structural neck injuries.
Just because they weren't braced for it.
Exactly. The musculature just isn't engaged to absorb the force.
That feeds directly into the second physiological mandate. And this one might be the most counterintuitive rule in all of sports.
The ducking.
Yes. When you're about to get hit, human instinct tells you to shrink, right? You wince, you brace, you duck.
You try to make yourself smaller.
Right. But the sources say ducking near the boards is arguably the single most dangerous physical action you can take on the ice.
Why? It's all about cervical spine mechanics, specifically this concept called axial loading.
Axial loading. What does that mean physically?
So when you stand normally with your head up, your spine has a natural curvature to it. It acts like a biological shock absorber.
Okay, like a spring.
Exactly. But when you duck, your chin tucks down toward your chest, and that physical action straightens the cervical vertebrae into a rigid vertical column.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah. If you suffer a headfirst collision with the boards in that posture, the spine can't bend to absorb the kinetic energy. Instead, the force compresses straight down that rigid column.
It just snaps.
It shatters the vertebrae. And the critical takeaway from the biomechanical research here is the speed threshold.
Right. How fast do you have to be going?
That's the scary part. A catastrophic cervical spine injury from axial loading doesn't require a player flying at 20 miles an hour. It can occur at the speed of a brisk walk.
Wait, seriously, walking speed?
Walking speed. Think about that. If your head is down and your spine is straight, there is no speed on a hockey rink slow enough to make a collision safe.
Wow. Okay, so if I'm on the wall, I can't turn my back to shield a puck, and I can't duck to slip under the shoulder of the big defenseman stepping up on me. What is the actual physical mechanism for surviving that hit?
You utilize what's called the fallback technique.
The fallback technique. How do I do it?
It's all about redirecting kinetic energy. First, you must turn your skates parallel to the boards. You accept the contact by pressing your forearm, your hip, and the side of your leg directly into the wall.
Basically making myself part of the boards.
Exactly. You anchor your center of mass against the immovable object, your head remains up, your chin is elevated off your chest, and your vision stays up ice.
But what if I get caught completely square? Like, I'm facing the glass and I can't turn my skates in time.
Then you put your gloves and the shaft of your stick flat against the glass. You use them to act as a physical crimple zone. It keeps your chest open and your head back. But you never, ever offer your spine.
Okay, so the checker's force bounces off your structure rather than crushing it. That is a brilliant mental model for the listener.
It really is.
If you take absolutely nothing else away from the physical side of this deep dive, remember this. The boards are your teammate if you use them to absorb force, and your absolute worst enemy if you turn your back on them.
Head up. Always.
Always. Okay, so let's move from pure survival to actual application. What do you do when you are pinned in your own defensive zone? Because this is where the mental discipline of the winger seems to get tested more than anywhere else.
Oh, absolutely. This is where shifts are won and lost.
Let's break down the defensive zone mechanics. The most common structure teams run is a low zone collapse. So the opposing team has the puck deep in our corner. My centerman and my defenseman are locked in this brutal two-on-two battle down low.
Right.
And the opposing puit defenseman, the guy I'm supposed to be covering, is just standing 50 feet away at the blue line, doing absolutely nothing.
Just watching the play.
Right. And every instinct in my body screams that I need to dive into that corner and help my teammates win the puck. Standing near the blue line watching them struggle just feels lazy. It feels wrong.
It feels wrong because it goes completely against that pack hunting mentality that young players are constantly taught.
Yeah, go to the puck.
Exactly. But from a structural standpoint, diving into that corner is the absolute most damaging thing a winger can do.
Walk me through the exact failure. What happens if I go help?
Let's look at the geometry. If you abandon your position high in the zone, meaning up near the blue line, to help low in the corner, you create a cascading structural failure. First, you leave that opposing defenseman completely unmarked.
Okay.
If the puck squirts out of that battle in the corner, which, you know, it does constantly, that defenseman now has unobstructed real estate to walk right down the center of the ice into the high slot. You have just gifted them the most dangerous shooting angle in the rink.
Because I got greedy and went for the puck.
Yes. And second, and this is the hidden cost, you have destroyed your own team's escape valve. Well, say your teammates down low do manage to win that puck. They turn to look up the wall to pass it out, and you weren't there.
Because I'm in the corner with them.
Exactly. So they have no outlet, they panic, they turn it over, and boom, you are trapped in your zone for another 45 seconds.
Okay, so I have to suppress the urge to help. I maintain my discipline, I stay high, I keep my moddy between the opposing defenseman and our net.
Right.
But I can't stand there forever. What is the exact mechanical trigger that tells me I am allowed to move?
The trigger is the exact millisecond possession changes hands. But this is where elite wingers separate themselves from average ones.
That's the difference.
You cannot wait to see your teammate clearly controlling the puck on their stick before you react, because by then the opposing defense has already adjusted. It's too late.
So it's anticipatory.
Exactly. You have to read the body mechanics of the battle in the corner. When you see your teammate leverage their hips, win the body position, and clearly initiate a puck win, that is your trigger.
Okay, so I read the win. What is my actual physical movement? Where am I going?
You immediately drop down the boards to the hash marks to present a target. Your skates are pointing up ice, your stick blade is flat on the ice offering a target, and your chest is open to the play. You are acting as the hinge for the entire breakout.
But wait, if I start turning my feet and dropping down before we have absolute possession, aren't I just doing the exact thing you warned against?
Leaving the point, man.
Yeah. What if I misread the battle, I drop down, and the other team wins it? Now that defenseman is wide open again.
And that right there is the defining tension of the position.
Oh.
It is a high-stakes tightrope walk. If you wait for absolute certainty, you'll be too slow, the passing lane will close, and the breakout dies.
But if I cheat too early, I get burned for goal against.
Exactly. So the mechanical solution is in your skate edges. You don't just blindly skate away. Okay. You pivot. You open your hips toward the play so you can step down toward the hash marks, but you keep your weight distributed so that if the battle is lost, you can immediately push off and drive right back up into the shooting lane of the point man. It is a state of coiled readiness.
Coiled readiness. I love that. Okay, let's assume the read was perfect. I drop to the hash marks. The puck is passed up the wall to me.
Great.
But I don't have clean ice. The opposing team's forward has tracked me, and suddenly there is a 200-pound player draped all over my back. We are now in a static wall battle. How do I physically win this?
It is entirely about center of gravity and leverage. You must establish a wide, low base.
Why wide and low?
Because if your skates are too close together, your center of gravity is high. A simple shove to your hips will knock you completely off the puck. You must drop your hips, widen your stance, and most importantly, keep your feet moving in short, choppy strides.
Oh, don't stand still.
Never stand still. A stationary target is easily pinned to the glass. A moving target, even one moving just a few inches at a time, forces the checker to constantly readjust their balance, preventing them from locking you down.
And this actually brings us to one of the most fascinating layers of the source material.
The free hand rules.
Yes. We talk about using your body to shield the puck, putting your backside into the checker, keeping the puck on the far side of your blade. But what about my free hand? Like, if a guy is leaning on my back, human instinct is to reach back with my free hand and push him off to create space, right?
It is.
But the rule books across different leagues treat this exact physical motion totally differently. It's wild.
It really is. The regulatory variations here actually rewire how a player has to think about their own body. Let's look at the NHL or IIHF rules. The rule book explicitly allows you to use a free arm to fend off an opponent.
So I can legally stiff-arm a guy to maintain my space.
You can put your forearm against their chest or block their stick, yes, provided you do not close your fingers and grab them.
Okay, but what if I'm, say, an American teenager playing under USA Hockey rules?
It changes completely. USA Hockey does not have a broad fend-off provision written into their primary rules. It's actually buried in their situational pacebook, and it comes with massive caveats.
Like what?
Well, under USA Hockey, you can only use that arm if you have undeniable control of the puck. But more critically, the moment you transition from statically fending off to actively extending your arm to push off and artificially create space, the referee will penalize you for holding or interference.
So I literally cannot push my way out of a battle.
You cannot.
And what if I cross the border and play a tournament under Hockey Canada rules?
Hockey Canada introduces yet another philosophical interpretation. Their rule 8.1 says you can use your hands, arms, or body in a strength move to block an opponent's stick, but only if you have established body position.
And the punitive stakes are much higher there, aren't they?
It's massively higher. Under Hockey Canada, if you grab a jersey or illegally hold a player on the wall, and that player happens to lose their balance and injure themselves, it's not a 2-minute minor. It is a mandatory major penalty and an automatic game misconduct.
Your night is just over.
You are ejected.
This is mind-blowing to think of. We always assume hockey is a universal language, you know. But an American winger playing a tournament in Ontario literally has to suppress their muscle memory.
Completely.
If they use their free hand the way they were taught in Detroit, they might get ejected in Toronto. It totally changes the physical geometry of how you win a wall battle based on whose logo is on the referee's jersey.
Precisely. You have to solve the physical problem using only the tools the specific rule book allows you to use.
Okay, so I'm pinned. I'm legally protecting the puck based on whatever rules I'm playing under.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to move the puck. I can't just stand there forever. My two primary estate valves are the rim and the reverse. Let's dig into the specific mechanics of when to use which, because they are diametric opposites. And choosing the wrong one is basically a guaranteed turnover. Let's start with the rim. I have the puck on the half wall, and the checker is on my back. When do I rim it?
You rim the puck when the checker is successfully sealing you from the inside.
Define sealing for me.
It means the checker has positioned their body between you and the center of the ice. They are actively taking away your ability to pass or skate toward the middle. They want you on the boards.
Because they're binning me outside.
Exactly. When you recognize that physical alignment, when you physically feel their weight leaning on your inside shoulder, you cannot force a pass to the middle. That is exactly how pucks get intercepted and end up in the back of your net.
So I use the boards instead.
You fire the puck hard, onward around the glass, trusting that your centerman or far side winger is reading the play and skating down to collect it on the other side of the zone.
I hear coaches scream about rimming the puck, though. It always feels like a panic move, right? Like you're just throwing the puck away blindly and hoping for the best. Is it actually a high percentage play?
It is entirely a high percentage play if you use it correctly.
Yeah.
It's a possession reset. Think of it as a pressure release valve.
Yep.
By firing it along the curve of the boards, you are bypassing the immediate threat, the checker who has you sealed, and moving the battle to a totally different area of the ice where your team might have a numerical advantage. It is far superior to attempting some low percentage hero pass through a defender's legs in your own zone.
That makes total sense. So that is the rim. What is the mechanical read for the reverse?
You reverse the puck when the checker commits a geometric error.
A geometric error? Like what?
Instead of sealing you from the inside and stopping their momentum, the checker comes at you way too aggressively. They carry too much speed, and as a result, they slightly overskate you.
So they end up positioned slightly ahead of me, closer to the blue line than I am.
Yes. And physics dictates that the space they just vacated, the space directly behind you, toward your own goal line, is now completely undefended.
So the reverse exploits that empty space.
Exactly. Instead of trying to force the puck forward into the checker's body, you send it back the exact way it just came. You bank it off the boards behind you to your supporting defenseman, who should be reading the play and swinging in below you.
It's basically a judo move. You are using their own aggressive momentum against them. If they charge past you, you just leave the puck where they used to be.
Perfectly said.
But if I misread the pressure, if I reverse the puck, when the checker is actually sealing me perfectly from behind, I'm just blindly dropping the puck directly onto their stick in my own zone.
Exactly. You just gave them a grade A scoring chance.
Mm-hmm.
The decision between rim and reverse is entirely dictated by reading the center of gravity and the momentum of the checker on your back.
Lisa, pull these defensive zone concepts together for the listener real quick to ensure these mental models are locking in. We've established four critical protocols so far.
Let's hear them.
First, suppress the instinct to chase. Stay high and cover your point man so you don't collapse your own structure.
Yak.
Second, anticipate the possession change by opening your hips, but keep your weight balanced so you don't cheat the zone early.
Right.
Third, win the wall battle with a low, wide base. and know exactly what your specific rule book says about using your free hand.
Crucial.
And fourth, read the checker's momentum. Rim the puck to beat an inside seal. Reverse it to punish an overcommitment. If we execute those, we finally get out of our zone.
Which brings us to the neutral zone.
Yes, the transition space.
Yep.
The primary objective here is to navigate the 50 feet between the blue lines without turning the puck over so you can establish an offensive attack.
Right.
Let's look at this from both sides of the puck. Suppose the opposing team breaks out and they're coming through the neutral zone toward us. How does a winger fundamentally alter their behavior based on the structural system the coach has called? Because defending in the neutral zone seems highly varied.
It varies wildly. It basically depends on whether you are running a containment trap, like a 1-2-2, or an aggressive press, like a 2-1-2.
Let's look at the containment structure first, the 1-2-2.
So if your team is running a 1-2-2, your centerman is usually the one up high applying light pressure. You and the other winger are the two stationed on the walls in the middle of the neutral zone.
Okay, so what's my job?
In the system, you are a roadblock.
Yeah.
Your only job is to occupy space and force the puck carrier to make a mistake.
But again, the instinct is to go get the puck. If I see the opposing defenseman stick handling 10 feet away from me, I want to close the gap and hit him.
And if you leave your lane to do that in a 1-2-2, the entire system instantly shatters.
Really? Just from me stepping up?
Think about the geometry behind you. You have one defenseman on your side of the ice backing you up. If you stay in your lane, that defenseman knows exactly where the threat is. But if you abandon your lane on the wall and dart into the middle of the ice to chase the puck carrier, you just left a massive gaping hole on the boards.
Oh, wow.
The opposing team simply passes the puck into the space you just vacated, and their winger is flying down the boards at full speed. Your lone defenseman cannot cover the middle of the ice and the boards simultaneously.
So by trying to do too much, I created a catastrophic structural breakdown.
Exactly. In containment, discipline is everything. You hold your lane, force them wide, and let them skate into a bad angle.
Okay, but what if we switch to an aggressive 2-1-2 press?
Then the rules completely invert. In an aggressive press, the coach wants you to force a turnover immediately. You are hunting.
So I don't wait?
No. If the puck is on the opposite side of the ice, making you the weak side winger, you don't stay in your lane holding space. You actively abandon your lane and collapse hard across the ice toward the puck carrier to outnumber them and kill the play.
So the critical takeaway is that you cannot play on instinct.
Yeah.
You must consciously know which system is active on every single shift.
Exactly. You have to think before you move.
All right, now let's take the puck back. We are moving through the neutral zone, attacking their blue line.
Mm-hmm.
But their defense is organized. They are standing up at the line, denying us entry. We can't just carry it in. We have to dump the puck in.
The dreaded dump in.
Exactly. Because I have to admit, when I watch hockey, a dump in often looks like a failure. It looks like the team ran out of ideas, so they just slap the puck into the corner and hope for a good bounce.
That is a very common misconception. A properly executed dump-in is a highly tactical, surgical possession play.
It's surgical?
Yes. You aren't giving the puck away. You are placing it into a specific geometric area of the ice where your team has a statistical advantage to retrieve it. There are five distinct types of dump-ins, and they are deploying as specific solutions to whatever structural problem the opposing defense is presenting.
I love this. Let's pressure test this right now.
Mm.
I will give you a structural problem, and you give me the mechanical dump-in solution.
Let's do it.
Problem number one. I'm carrying the puck up the right wall. The opposing defense has collapsed tightly into the middle of the ice. My centerman is flying down the center lane, but he's totally blocked. I want to get the puck to the far left corner where my left winger is streaking in.
The solution is the hard rim.
The hard rim.
You strike the puck with heavy force, wrapping it around the glass of the near corner so it continues its trajectory all the way behind the net to the far corner.
Because the defense is clogged in the middle.
Exactly. The rim bypasses their entire structure along the outside edge of the rink. You are using the boards to send the puck to the exact space where your left winger will arrive first.
Problem number two. I'm attacking the line, but I see that the opposing defenseman on my side has incredibly bad gap control. He's backing up way too fast, giving me tons of room, but my teammates are exhausted and changing behind the play. I have no support.
You use the soft area dump?
Soft area dump.
You want to execute a gentle chip, lobbing the puck just over the blue line into the near corner so that it dies there with minimal bounce. Because the defenseman backed off too far, you have effectively bought yourself a 10-foot head start. You place the puck in the corner, knowing you have the speed and the angle to go get it yourself before he can stop his backward momentum and pivot.
Oh, that's smart. Okay. Problem number three, and this is the scary one. I'm carrying the puck up the wall. I reach the red line. I look up, and the opposing defenseman is stepping up aggressively. Yeah. He is not backing down. He is closing the gap rapidly and intends to hit me incredibly hard right at the blue line. I don't have time to rim it or set up a soft dump.
This calls for the chip past the defenseman. And honestly, this is one of the highest value individual plays a winger can make.
How does it work?
You do not absorb the hit with the puck. A split second before impact, you flick the puck lightly off the board so it bounces just past the defenseman's hip into the offensive zone. Simultaneously, you absorb the contact, spin off it, or duck around his opposite side.
It's the exact mechanic of a winger in soccer running down the touchline.
Yes.
A defender steps up, the soccer player kicks the ball 5 yards past the defender, sprints out of bounds around them, and re-enters the pitch to collect the ball. You are turning a physical confrontation into a pure foot race, using the boards as a wall pass teammate.
That is a brilliant mechanical analogy. You are utilizing their aggressive momentum to remove them from the play entirely. The moment you chip it past them and get around their body, they are out of the picture and you have clean possession in the zone.
Awesome. Problem four. The defense is playing a standard structure, but I noticed the weak side defenseman, the guy on the opposite side of the ice, is playing on his offside. Like he's a left-handed shot playing the right side, meaning his stick is toward the middle of the ice.
You deploy the cross-corner dump.
Cross-corner.
You fire the puck hard and diagonally across the ice into his corner. The geometry here is crucial. By forcing him to retrieve a puck in that specific corner, you force him to turn his back to the play and retrieve the puck on his backhand.
Which is awkward.
It is an incredibly awkward, unnatural physical retrieval that takes extra seconds to execute. Those extra seconds are all your forecheckers need to arrive and pin him.
Wow, just exploiting his handedness. Okay, problem five. I'm coming up the ice, but there is absolutely nowhere to go. The opposing team has set up a 1-3-1 trap. They have four players standing perfectly still across the neutral zone, linking arms conceptually, completely clogging every inch of the ice.
You use the flip or the area dump over a trap.
Like a lob.
Yes. Since there are no lateral passing lanes and no lanes to skate through, you utilize the vertical Z axis. You open the blade of your stick and flip the puck high into the air over the heads of the four trapping players, aiming to land it in the vast, empty real estate behind them.
But there is a massive risk here regarding icing, right? Like, if I hit it too hard and it flies all the way down the ice across the goal line untouched, the whistle blows, we get an icing penalty, and the faceoff comes all the way back to our zone.
Exactly. You must calibrate the flip to land short of the goal line. And this is another scenario where you absolutely must understand the rule book you are operating under, because icing regulations totally change the tactical viability of this play.
How so?
Well, in the NHL, if your team is killing a penalty, meaning you are shorthanded, the icing rule is completely suspended for your team. You can fire the puck from your own goal line all the way down the ice as hard as you want.
Right.
But under USA Hockey, if you are playing below the Youth 15 only level, that exemption does not exist.
Really?
Yeah. If you are shorthanded and you clear the puck all the way down the ice, it is blown dead for icing, and the faceoff comes right back into your defensive zone. The pressure never resets.
So a 14-year-old killing a penalty in Chicago has to rely on short tactical chips to get the puck out, whereas an NHL player can just launch it 200 feet to buy time. That radically changes how a coach designs a penalty kill structure.
It forces younger players to learn possession exits rather than relying on brute force clears, which is exactly why the rule was implemented in the first place.
That makes total sense. Let's transition to actually carrying the puck across the line. Let's say we beat the trap. We didn't dump it in. We are attacking the blue line with speed.
Okay.
The most fundamental rule in hockey is that the puck must cross the blue line into the offensive zone before any attacking player does. This introduces the most iconic physical mechanic of a winger, dragging the trailing skate. Break down the physics of this for me.
Sure. So as a winger, you are usually the player attacking the blue line on the absolute widest part of the ice, trying to stretch the defense. Often, your centerman is carrying the puck in the middle, slightly behind you.
Okay.
Because you are skating faster than the puck carrier, your momentum is carrying you over the line too early. To avoid being called offside, you have to dramatically widen your stride. You reach forward with your front foot into the offensive zone, stretching your stick out to receive the pass, while you intentionally drag your back skate backward, anchoring it to the blue line.
Because the rule explicitly states that you were only offside when both skates completely crossed the blue line before the puck. So your head, your chest, your stick, and your front leg can all be 3 feet inside the offensive zone, and as long as that back toe is touching the paint of the blue line, you are legally onside.
That is the exact anatomical requirement, but here again, the rule books fracture globally, and the difference fundamentally changes the physical execution of the move.
What is the discrepancy this time?
It centers on the definition of contact. Under NHL and IIHF rules, that trailing skate does not actually have to physically touch the ice.
Wait, it doesn't?
Nope. As long as the skate is physically breaking the vertical plane of the blue line, meaning it is hovering in the air directly above the paint, you are considered onside.
But amateur rules in North America demand physical contact, right?
Right. Yes. Under USA Hockey and Hockey Canada, the plane means absolutely nothing. Your trailing skate must be in physical, tangible contact with the ice itself. If you drag your skate but lift your blade a millimeter off the surface right as the puck crosses, the whistle blows. You are offside.
So, does requiring the skate to physically touch the ice actually make the game safer? Or does it just make the linesman's job easier because they don't have to judge a hover?
It is predominantly to aid officiating, but it ironically introduces a massive safety hazard.
Really?
Yeah. The act of dragging a skate while stretching forward throws a player completely off balance. And this is where the most dangerous collisions occur. Remember, your body is entering the offensive zone before your feet do. You are leaning headfirst into the exact territory that an opposing defenseman is stepping up to violently defend.
Oh, man.
If you drop your head to look down at your trailing skate to make sure it's physically touching the line, you are taking your eyes off the defenseman.
You are skating face-first into a 200-pound shoulder that you never saw coming.
Exactly. It is a devastating mechanism for concussions. You must learn to feel the blue line with the edge of your blade by proprioception, keeping your eyes entirely focused up ice on the defender. Hmm. Head up, chin off the chest, always.
And what happens if someone messes up? The winger crosses early, the puck comes in late, the referee raises his arm for a delayed offside. The instinct for a lot of recreational players is just to stop playing and wait for the whistle.
But there is no whistle, provided your team doesn't touch the puck. The play remains live under a delayed offside.
So what's the mandate?
The mandate here is that tagging up is a five-man collective action. Every single attacking player, all five of you, must simultaneously exit the offensive zone and make physical contact with the blue line or the neutral zone before anyone is allowed to legally re-enter and touch the puck.
So if four players tag up, but I am still lazily skating a circle deep in the corner.
The zone remains closed. If someone touches the puck, the whistle blows.
And just add another layer of regulatory complexity here. If you are playing USA Hockey at the younger youth levels, delayed offside doesn't even exist. The second a player crosses early, the play is instantly blown dead. There is no tag up allowed at all.
Which completely changes the flow of the transition game for those age groups.
Definitely. Yeah. Okay, so we survived the neutral zone. We dragged our skate, kept our head up, and crossed the line legally.
Mm.
We are now in section four, the offensive zone. The goal here is generating high-danger scoring chances. But creating that chaos requires a rigid underlying structure. Where is my home base? If I'm not actively hunting the puck, where am I supposed to be standing?
Your default anchor point is the half wall.
The half wall?
Yes. This is the area of the boards roughly halfway between the blue line and the goal line, parallel to the faceoff dot. From the half wall, you have optimal vision. You can pass down low to the corner, you can pass up high to the point, or you can shoot.
What I shouldn't do, I assume, is drift into the middle of the ice between the circles, the high slot.
Never drift into the high slot unless you are specifically rotating. The high slot belongs to your centerman. If you abandon the half wall and drift into the center space, you commit the exact same geometric sin we discussed in the defensive zone.
I bring my defender with me.
Yes. You clog the lane and you allow one defenseman to guard both of you. You literally suffocate your own offense.
All right, let's talk about the forecheck. We dumped the puck in using one of the five methods we discussed, and now we are hunting it down. We constantly hear analysts talk about F1, F2, and F3. My initial assumption when I started learning the game was that F1 was the centerman, and F2 and F3 were the wingers. But that's completely wrong, isn't it?
It is entirely wrong. F1, F2, and F3 are not assigned positions based on the logo on your jersey. They are fluid, temporary roles dictated exclusively by chronological arrival time. It is a state machine.
Explain the mechanics of that state machine. How do I know which one I am?
If you dump the puck and you are physically the first player to cross the blue line and arrive at the puck, Congratulations, you are F1. It does not matter if you are the right winger, the left winger, or the center.
What's my job as F1?
As F1, your sole objective is to hit the opposing defenseman who is retrieving the puck or force them to make a rushed, panicked pass. You are the tip of the spear.
Okay, so if I'm skating in slightly behind F1, I am F2. What is my geometric responsibility?
As F2, you are the reader. You watch the physical angle F1 takes. F1 will naturally cut off one side of the ice. Your job is to identify the next most likely escape route the defenseman will use, usually up the boards or reverse behind the net, and you seal that route off.
Got it.
Your goal is to intercept the panicked pass that F1 forces. And a critical mechanical note here. When F2 engages, you are pinning the puck against the boards with your stick and skates. Mm. You cannot wrap your arms around the opposing player and pin their body to the wall.
Because that's a holding penalty in literally every rule book.
Exactly. You play the puck, not the man.
And the third player in,
yeah.
F3.
F3 is the safety valve. You do not dive into the corner with F1 and F2. You stay high in the zone, usually around the top of the face-off circles, hovering near the middle of the ice. You are the final line of defense.
In case it all goes wrong.
Right. If F1 and F2 get beaten and the opposing team breaks out, your central high position ensures they don't get a clean breakaway down the middle of the ice.
Okay, let's move from the structured flow of the forecheck to the most violent, chaotic, and heavily regulated 10 square feet of ice in the rink. The crease. The net front.
Oh, yeah.
This is where wingers make their living on tip-ins, screens, and rebounds. But earlier, you described this area as the one place on the ice where you are expected to take contact you literally cannot see coming. Break down the physics of net front survival for me.
The biomechanics of playing the net front are entirely counterintuitive. In a normal hockey scenario, you are facing the player hitting you. At the net front, your primary job is to screen the goaltender and watch the point defenseman 50 feet away for the shot.
So my back is to the net.
Your back is to the opposing defensemen, who are tasked with clearing you out of the crease. By design, you are taking heavy cross-checks to your lower back and hips from players you cannot visually track.
That sounds like a recipe for a shattered lumbar spine. How do you actually survive a blind cross-check from a 230-pound defender?
You must establish an elite structural brace. You widen your feet slightly beyond shoulder width, bend your knees deeply, and drop your center of gravity. You let your massive glute and quad muscles absorb the kinetic energy of the shove rather than your lower back.
Okay.
But the most vital survival mechanism is proprioception regarding the goalposts.
Knowing where the steel is.
Exactly. You must tap the post with your stick or briefly feel it with your skate before you establish your screen. If you take a blind shove and you don't know exactly where the post is, you can be violently pushed backward, head first, into a solid steel pipe.
And again, if you feel that shove coming, the instinct might be to duck away from it.
Which circles right back to our first golden rule. If you duck, you straighten your cervical spine. If you duck and hit the steel post with the top of your helmet, the axial loading will cause catastrophic spinal compression. You never duck, you absorb the blow with your hips.
The physical danger is terrifying enough, but the legalities of the crease are where things get truly mind-bending. This is where the rule books absolutely fracture, and they dictate exactly how a winger is allowed to exist in this space.
It's very complex.
Let's start with the NHL and the IIHF. I'm standing just outside the blue paint, screening the goalie. Legal.
Completely legal. Under NHL and IIHF rules, as long as you are outside the boundary of the crease and not making physical contact with the goalie, you have a right to that ice. The goalie must look around you.
But what if that big defenseman cross-checks me in the back and I am physically shoved into the blue paint right as my teammate shoots the puck and scores?
Under NHL rules, being violently shoved into the crease is not a free pass to just stay there. No. The rule dictates that if your physical position inside the crease impairs the goalie's ability to move or see, the goal is disallowed, regardless of who initiated the contact. The referee expects you to make a reasonable, immediate effort to vacate the paint. If you just accept the shove and camp out in the crease, the goal comes off the board.
Okay, that's the NHL. What about amateur rules in the United States? USA Hockey.
USA Hockey Rule 625B takes a much more draconian approach to the geometry of the crease. They do not care about the goalie's vision. They care about the strict physical boundary. Under USA Hockey, no goal can be scored if an attacking player's body or stick is anywhere inside the crease, period.
Wow.
The only exceptions are if the puck enters the crease before you do, or if the goalie is completely out of the crease area.
Wait, so if I just have my skate an inch over the line and the puck goes in, No goal. What if I get shoved in?
USA Hockey does offer a push-in exemption. If a defender physically forces you into the crease and you had no ability to stop it, the goal will stand.
Okay, so USA Hockey is strict on the boundary, but lenient if you're a victim of a shove. But you noted in our source material that Hockey Canada is the most extreme.
Hockey Canada's interpretation rewires the entire psychology of net front play. Under Interpretation 2 of Rule 8.5, if a defenseman illegally cross-checks you in the back and the force of that illegal hit sends you crashing into the goaltender, the winger who was hit, are required to make a demonstrable physical effort to avoid the contact with the goalie.
Let me make sure I am understanding this correctly. I am standing legally outside the crease. A defenseman commits a penalty by violently cross-checking me in the spine. I am sent flying out of control into the goalie. And Hockey Canada says I have to make an effort to avoid the collision while falling.
Yes. The referee is looking for an attempt to twist your body, lift your skates, or redirect your momentum. If they judge that you simply let the contact happen without trying to avoid it, you will be penalized for goaltender interference.
That is profound victim blaming. The winger gets assaulted in the back and they go to the penalty box.
It is a philosophy rooted in ultimate goaltender protection. They are enforcing the idea that the goalie's safety is the paramount concern on the ice, superseding the cause of the collision. And it scales up aggressively.
How so?
If you collide with the goalie under this rule and the goalie is injured, Hockey Canada mandates a major penalty and an automatic game misconduct. You are ejected from the game.
This is exactly what we meant in the intro by Rulebook Neuroplasticity. An American winger playing a tournament in Toronto literally has to rewrite their physical instincts around the net. In Detroit, they take the shove and brace. In Toronto, if they take the shove, they have to instantly contort their body in midair to avoid brushing the goalie's pad, or they might get thrown out of the game.
Yeah, that's wild.
How much of what scouts call hockey instinct is actually just deeply conditioned compliance to the local rule book?
It is an incredible question. It highlights how geography dictates biomechanics. And just to finalize the geometry of the crease itself. When we say in the crease, we must define the boundary.
Right.
In the IIHF, USA Hockey, and Hockey Canada, the 2-inch red line that outlines the blue paint is explicitly defined as part of the crease. If your skate blade is touching the red paint, you are in the crease. The NHL is the only major rule book that leaves the status of the red line unstated in its definition.
Incredible. Let's do a quick mastery check on the offensive zone before we move on. F1, F2, and F3 are fluid roles based purely on chronological arrival time, not your position. Net front survival requires a wide, low brace to absorb blind hits, and you absolutely must know where the steel post is. And most importantly, your right to exist near the crease is entirely dictated by which league's rulebook is sitting on the scorekeeper's bench.
Perfectly summarized.
That brings us to Section 5, Special Teams and Situational Awareness. 5-on-5 systems like the low zone collapse and the 1-2-2 trap cover 80% of the game. But the structural demands on a winger change radically during specific events, face-offs, power plays, and icings. Let's start with the restart of play, the face-off. I line up on the hash marks on the circle. It seems pretty straightforward.
It seems straightforward until you analyze the encroachment mechanics. The most common error a winger makes on a face-off isn't tactical, it's positional.
Positional.
Yes. The hash marks are not a suggestion, they are a rigid geometric boundary. If you lean your upper body over that line before the puck leaves the referee's hand, the whistle will blow for an encroachment violation.
But the referee doesn't throw me, the winger, out of the circle.
No, and that is the punishing aspect of the rule. Your encroachment violation gets your centerman ejected from the dock.
Oh, man.
You force your team to take a vital face-off with a replacement player, usually the other winger, who is statistically much less likely to win the draw. You have actively harmed your team's possession metrics because you couldn't keep your shoulders back.
And what about my stick? Could I rest my stick over the line?
Again, rulebook variation. In an NHL and IIHF, your stick blade is permitted to cross the hash marks into the circle, provided it does not make physical contact with the opposing winger's body or stick. But under USA Hockey and Hockey Canada, the geometry is absolute. Your skates, your body, and your stick must all remain entirely behind the plane of the hash marks.
What if the centerman does get tossed, and I am the winger forced to step into the dot and take the draw?
Then you transition from the rules of a winger to the rules of the player taking the faceoff, and the physiological stakes rise instantly, particularly regarding head positioning. When two players lean over a puck, their heads are inches apart. The IIHF has a hyper-strict mandate on this. If you lean in too aggressively and your helmet makes contact with the opposing center's helmet, the referee will assess a penalty, and the IIHF rulebook explicitly states the player responsible may be ejected. Helmet-to-helmet contact is treated with zero tolerance.
Let's talk about what happens when we win that face-off on a power play. The dominant offensive structure in modern hockey is the 1-3-1 power play.
It is the apex of offensive geometric design. You have one player high at the point. You have three players arrayed across the middle, typically a winger on each half wall, and a bumper player hovering in the high slot. And you have one player anchored at the net front.
As a winger, I am usually stationed on the half wall. If the 1-3-1 is an NBA offense, the half wall winger is the point guard. The entire offense flows through my decision making.
That is the exact mechanical reality. You are the quarterback. Standing on the half wall, you possess four distinct geometric passing options. You can pass the puck backward to the point man. You can slip a short, quick pass inside to the bumper in the slot. You can feed it down low to the net front player. Or you can attempt the most devastating pass in hockey. The cross seam pass, slicing through the penalty killer's box to the winger on the far half wall.
Why is the cross seam pass so devastating?
Because it breaks the goaltender's lateral tracking mechanics. A goalie can slide side to side to track the puck, but a hard pass across the Royal Road, the imaginary line running straight up the middle of the ice, forces the goalie to completely reset their visual angle and their physical hips in a fraction of a second. If the far winger one-timers that pass, the puck is in the net before the goalie can physically stop their lateral momentum.
So how did the penalty killer stop that? If we are on the penalty kill, shorthanded, 4-on-5, what is our structural shape?
The penalty kill is entirely about structural integrity and denying that cross-seam geometry. You are typically deployed in a box, a diamond, or a wedge plus one formation.
Explain the wedge plus one.
Three penalty killers form a tight triangle, the wedge down low in front of the net to protect the most dangerous ice. You, as the plus one winger, operate at the top of the wedge, floating between the puck carrier and the point man.
My job is to prevent the cross-seam pass by getting my stick in the lane right.
Yes. Your stick is a physical barrier disrupting the passing lane. You want to force the point guard on the half wall to make a low percentage decision. You bait them into taking a shot from a bad angle.
And when they take that shot, my job is to block it.
But you must block it with precise anatomical mechanics.
Walk me through the biomechanics of a safe shot block.
First, you remain on your feet, squaring your chest directly to the shooter. You do not turn your side to the puck, because the side of your knee and your ribs are highly vulnerable. Second, you place your arms firmly behind your back. If you dangle your hands at your sides, the puck will shatter the small bones in your fingers or wrists.
That sounds painful.
It is. Third, and most importantly, you never drop to one knee and tuck your head behind your shin pads.
Because that exposes the back of my neck.
Exactly. It presents your cervical spine and the back of your helmet to a puck traveling 90 miles an hour. You stay tall, you take the impact on the heavily padded chest protector or shin guards, and there is a vital spatial awareness rule here. If you cannot physically get into the lane to block the shot, you must instantly bail out and get out of the way.
Get out of the way, why?
If you stand halfway in the lane, you aren't blocking the puck, you are just screening your own goaltender. A goalie can stop a puck they can see. They cannot stop a puck that materializes from behind your legs.
Let's pivot from special teams to a highly specific situational rule. Icing. We touched on this during the neutral zone dump-ins, but we need to unpack the mechanics of the icing chase. Let's start with the release. How do I avoid causing an icing when I dump the puck?
The geometric trigger for icing is the center red line. The rule mandates that the puck must be physically on your stick blade at the exact moment the puck makes contact with the red paint of the center line. If the puck leaves your blade 12 inches before the red line, it is an illegal dump and icing will be called.
But assuming it's a legal release, or borderline one, the puck goes down the ice and we enter the chase. The modern NHL and most high-level leagues use hybrid icing. The common misconception among fans is that hybrid icing is just a pure foot race to the face-off dots, and whoever's skate crosses the dot first wins.
That is a profound misunderstanding of the rule's architecture. The face-off dot is not a finish line. It is a decision deadline for the linesman.
This is where I like to use the drag race analogy. Imagine two cars drag racing, but the race doesn't end at the finish line. Instead, a judge standing at the halfway mark looks at the speed and momentum of both cars as they pass him and declares who would win the race, ending it right there before they crash into the wall.
That analogy perfectly captures the spirit of the rule. The linesman is evaluating momentum and trajectory. They must make a definitive judgment by the time the first player reaches the face-off dot regarding who would reach the puck first.
So mechanically, how does a winger play that chase?
You must expend 100% of your energy in the first half of the chase. You sprint from the blue line to the top of the circles because that is where the visual judgment is won or lost. If you realize at the hash marks that the opposing defenseman has clearly beaten you and the linesman's arm is going up for icing, you structurally shut down.
You just give up.
You ease up on your edges, you coast, and you prepare to stop. The entire point of hybrid icing is to prevent two players from crashing into the end boards at full speed for a puck one of them was never going to win. Attempting to accelerate past the dot when you are already beaten is dangerous, pointless, and structurally ignorant.
And the penalties for icing vary significantly by rulebook, correct? It's not just a face-off in your zone.
The regulatory punishments are severe. In the NHL and IIHF, if your team commits an icing, the players on the ice are legally prohibited from executing a line change. You are trapped. Furthermore, your coach is not permitted to call a timeout to rest you. You are physically exhausted, lactic acid is burning in your legs, and you have to defend a defensive zone face-off against a fresh line of opposing attackers.
What about amateur hockey?
USA Hockey is more forgiving. They permit line changes after an icing, but the referee will only grant you 5 to 7 seconds to execute it. If you dawdle, they drop the puck whether you are ready or not.
And Canada?
Hockey Canada occupies a strange middle ground. They allow the coach to call a timeout after an icing to rest the tired players, but they explicitly forbid the coach from substituting players during that timeout. You can breathe, but you cannot leave.
Brutal. Okay, the final situational topic, backchecking. We are in the offensive zone, we turn the puck over, and the other team transitions up the ice on a rush.
The physical mandate is simple. Sprint backward. You take the outside lanes along the boards, allowing your centerman to occupy the middle lane. But your cognitive job as a backchecking winger is highly specific. Your eyes must immediately scan the ice to identify F3.
F3 being the third forward on their rush, the late arriving trailer.
Yes. Human psychology naturally draws everyone's eyes to the puck carrier. Your defensemen are already occupied matching the speed and angles of the first wave of attackers. The late arriving F3 is the most dangerous geometric threat on the ice because they are skating into the high slot entirely unmarked with downward momentum.
So it's my job.
Your sole defensive responsibility on the backcheck is to locate that trailer, match their speed, and physically insert your body between them and the passing lane. You eliminate the trailer.
Let me throw out a reinforcement question for the listener. Tying together the physiological safety points we've covered across all these scenarios, from the wall battles to the net front to blocking shots, why is it structurally worse to duck when facing physical impact than it is to take a slap shot straight to the chest?
Because ducking fundamentally compromises the biomechanical integrity of your spine. Taking a 90-mile-an-hour puck to the chest protector will hurt. You'll have a massive bruise. Taking a heavy hit to the shoulder will hurt. But dropping your chin and straightening your cervical spine removes its ability to act as a shock absorber. Taking an impact to the top of a straightened neck can cause irreversible paralysis at walking speed. You must maintain structural integrity. Head up, chest square, let your muscular base absorb the force.
Powerful, terrifying, and absolutely vital. All right, we've covered the entire length of the ice. We have reached the outro. It's time for our final mastery review. Connect all these geometric, physical, and regulatory dots for us. How should a winger integrate all of this into a single mental model?
Mastery of the winger position requires abandoning the illusion of chaos. It is a holistic, interlocking system. It requires mastering the geometry of the rink, understanding how your physical lane spacing manipulates the defense's width, and how your gap control on the point man prevents structural collapse. It requires elite split-second anticipation, knowing the exact biomechanical cue to drop for a breakout pass, or reading a checker's momentum to choose between a rim and a reverse. And above all, it requires a precise encyclopedic understanding of the rulebook. You cannot execute the physics of a net front screen or a blue line entry if you do not understand the microscopic regulatory differences that dictate what is legal and what will get you ejected.
Let's distill this entire masterclass into the top 10 things to remember synthesis. If you only remember 10 concepts from this deep dive, make it these. Number one, stay in your outside lane to mathematically stretch the defense. Moving to the center destroys your spatial advantage.
That's right.
Number two, physiological survival is paramount. Never turn your back to the boards and never duck your head. Number three, in the defensive zone, maintain your discipline. Stay high and cover the point man. Only drop to the hash marks when possession is definitively won.
Essential.
Number four, use the boards to solve pressure. Rim the puck to bypass an inside seal. Reverse the puck to punish a checker's overcommitment. Number five, when attacking the blue line, anchor your trailing skate, but never drop your eyes to look at it. Trust your proprioception.
Number six, on the forecheck, F1, F2, and F3 are not permanent identities. They are fluid roles dictated entirely by who crosses the blue line first. Number seven, the crease is a heavily regulated danger zone. Survive blind hits with a wide brace, know where the post is, and intimately know your specific league's rules regarding goaltender interference.
Number eight, on faceoffs, encroachment is a selfish penalty that gets your centerman ejected. Keep your shoulders, skates, and stick firmly behind the hash marks. Number nine, hybrid icing is a judgment of momentum, not a foot race to the end boards. The faceoff dot is the decision deadline. Sprint the first half and shut down if beaten.
And number 10, on the back check, your eyes must break away from the puck carrier. Always identify and physically cover the late arriving trailing forward, F3.
It is truly staggering how much of this physical, violent game is actually governed by high-level cognitive processing. This leads me to the final provocative thought for you to mull over. We constantly hear commentators talk about a player's natural hockey instinct. We assume sports are a universal physical language. A puck is a puck, ice is ice, no matter where you are. But based on the source material we unpacked today, an American winger crossing the border to play a tournament in Canada literally has to rewire their neural pathways. They have to suppress their instinct to fend off a checker with a free hand. They have to physically ensure their trailing skate touches the ice on an entry. And if they are violently cross-checked into the crease, they have to instantly twist their falling body to avoid a goaltender just to escape an ejection.
The physical environment is identical, but the regulatory environment changes the biomechanics completely.
Exactly. So it forces you to wonder, how much of what we celebrate as pure natural instinct in an athlete is actually just deeply conditioned rule compliance, ingrained into their muscle memory based entirely on the zip code where they happen to lace up their first pair of skates? Because if you look closely enough at the chaos, you might just be watching a high-speed reading of a rulebook. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Keep your head up out there.